Good evening. Welcome to the Just Sleep podcast. I'm Tayshia, your host. Every week, I will read you an old story to help you relax, put the stressful day behind you, and drift off to sleep. Occasionally, we will run ads in order to cover the costs of the production of the podcast. Rest assured, there will be no ads during or after the story. If you prefer an ad-free and intro-free show, you can join Just Sleep Premium. Visit justsleeppodcast.com/support for more information.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tonight, I will be continuing the story of the Blue Castle by Lucy Maud Montgomery. So lie down, close your eyes, and let me read you a story. Chapter 4. Got your rubbers on? Called Cousin Stickles, as Valency left the house. Christine Stickles had never once forgotten to ask that question when Valency went out on a damp day. Yes. Have you got your flannel petticoat on? Asked Mrs. Frederick. No. Doss, I really do not understand you. Do you want to catch your death of cold again? Her voice implied that Valency had died of a cold several times already. Go upstairs this minute and put it on. Mother, I do not need a flannel petticoat. My sateen one is warm enough. Doss, remember you had bronchitis 2 years ago. Go and do as you are told. Valency went, though nobody will ever know just how near she came to hurling the rubber plant into the street before she went. She hated that grey flannel petticoat more than any other garment she owned. Olive never had to wear flannel petticoats. Olive wore ruffled silk and sheer lawn and filmy laced flounces. But Olive's father had married money, and Olive never had bronchitis. So there you were. Are you sure you didn't leave the soap in the water? Demanded Mrs. Frederick. But Valency was gone. She turned at the corner and looked back down the ugly, prim, respectable street where she lived. The Sterling house was the ugliest on it, more like a red brick box than anything else. too high for its breadth, and made still higher by a bulbous glass cupola on top. About it was the desolate, barren peace of an old house whose life is lived. There was a very pretty house, with leaded casements and dubbed gables, just around the corner. A new house, one of those houses you love the minute you see them. Clayton Markley had built it for his bride. He was to be married to Jenny Lloyd in June. The little house, it was said, was furnished from attic to cellar, in complete readiness for its mistress. "I don't envy Jenny the man," thought Valency sincerely. Clayton Markley was not one of her many ideals. "But I do envy her the house. It's such a nice young house. But if I could only have a house of my own, ever so poor, so tiny, but my own. But then," she added bitterly, "there's no use in yowling for the moon when you can't even get a tallow candle." In dreamland, nothing would do for Valency but a castle of pale sapphire. In real life, she would have been fully satisfied with a little house of her own. She envied Jenny Lloyd more fiercely than ever today. Jenny was not so much better looking than she was, and not so much younger. Yet she was to have this delightful house, and the nicest little Wedgwood teacups, Valency had seen them, an open fireplace, and monogrammed linen, hem-stitched tablecloths and china closets. Why did everything come to some girls and nothing to others? It wasn't fair. Valency was once more seething with rebellion as she walked along, a prim, dowdy little figure in her shabby raincoat and three-year-old hat, splashed occasionally by the mud of a passing motor with its insulting shrieks. Motors were still rather a novelty in Darewood, though they were common in Port Lawrence, and most of the summer residents up at Muskoka had them. In Darewood, only some of the smart set had them, for even Darewood was divided into sets. There was the smart set, the intellectual set, the old family set, of which the Sterlings were members, the common run, and a few pariahs. Not one of the Sterling clan had as yet condescended to a motor, though Olive was teasing her father to have one. Valency had never even been in a motor car, but she did not hanker after this. In truth, she felt rather afraid of motor cars, especially at night. They seemed to be too much like big purring beasts that might turn and crush you or make some terrible savage leap somewhere. On the steep mountain trails around her blue castle, only gaily caparisoned steeds might proudly pace. In real life, Valency would have been quite contented to drive in a buggy behind a nice horse. She got a buggy drive only when some uncle or cousin remembered to fling her a chance, like a bone to a dog. Chapter 5. Of course, she must buy the tea in Uncle Benjamin's grocery store. To buy it anywhere else was unthinkable. Yet Valency hated to go to Uncle Benjamin's store on her 29th birthday. There was no hope that he would not remember it. "Why," demanded Uncle Benjamin leeringly as he tied up her tea, "are young ladies like bad grammarians?" Valency, with her Uncle Benjamin's will in the background of her mind, said meekly, "I don't know. Why?" "Because," chuckled Uncle Benjamin, "they can't decline matrimony." The two Clarks, Joe Hammond and Claude Bertram, chuckled also, and Valency disliked them a little more than ever. On the first day Claude Bertram had seen her in the store, she had heard him whisper to Joe, "Who is that?" And Joe had said, "Valency Sterling, one of the Darewood old maids." "Curable or incurable?" Claude had asked with a snicker, evidently thinking the question very clever. Valency smarted anew with the sting of that old recollection. 29, Uncle Benjamin was saying. "Dear me, Doss, you're dangerously near the second corner, and not even thinking of getting married yet." 29. It seems impossible. Then Uncle Benjamin said an original thing. Uncle Benjamin said, "How time does fly." "I think it crawls," said Valency passionately. Passion was so alien to Uncle Benjamin's conception of Valency that he didn't know what to make of her. To cover up his confusion, he asked another conundrum as he tied up her beans. Cousin Stickles had remembered at the last moment that they must have beans. Beans were cheap and filling. "What two ages are apt to prove illusory?" asked Uncle Benjamin. And, not waiting for Valency to give it up, he added, "Mirage and marriage." "M-I-R-A-G-E is pronounced mirage," said Valency shortly, picking up her tea and her beans. For the moment, she did not care whether Uncle Benjamin cut her out of his will or not. She walked out of the store while Uncle Benjamin stared after her with his mouth open. Then he shook his head. "Poor Doss has taken it hard," he said. Valency was sorry by the time she reached the next crossing. Why had she lost her patience like that? Uncle Benjamin would be annoyed and would likely tell her mother that Doss had been impertinent to me, and her mother would lecture her for a week. "I've held my tongue for 20 years, thought Valency. "Why couldn't I have held it once more?" Yes, it was just 20, Valency reflected, since she had first been twitted with her loverless condition. She remembered the bitter moment perfectly. She was just 9 years old, and she was standing alone on the school playground, while the other little girls of her class were playing a game in which you must be chosen by a boy as his partner before you could play. Nobody had chosen Valency. Little, pale, black-haired Valency, with her prim, long-sleeved apron and odd eyes. "Oh," said a pretty little girl near to her, "I'm so sorry for you. You haven't got a bow." Valency had said defiantly, as she continued to say for 20 years, "I don't want a bow." But this afternoon, Valency once and for all stopped saying that. "I'm going to be honest with myself anyhow," she thought savagely. "Uncle Benjamin's riddles hurt me because they are true. I do want to be married. I want a house of my own. I want a husband of my own. I want sweet little fat babies of my own." Valency stopped suddenly aghast at her own recklessness. She felt sure that Reverend Dr. Stalling, who passed her at this moment, read her thoughts and disapproved of them thoroughly. Valency was afraid of Dr. Stalling, had been afraid of him ever since the Sunday, 23 years before, when he had first come to St. Albans. Valency had been too late for Sunday school that day, and she had gone into the church timidly and sat in their pew. No one else was in the church, nobody except the new rector, Dr. Stalling. Dr. Stalling stood up in front of the choir door, beckoned to her, and said sternly, "Little boy, come up here." Valency had stared around her. There was no little boy. There was no one in all the church but herself. This strange man with the blue glasses couldn't mean her. She was not a boy. "Little boy," repeated Dr. Stalling, more sternly still, shaking his forefinger fiercely at her, "come up here at once." Valency arose as if hypnotized and walked up the aisle. She was too afraid to do anything else. What dreadful thing was going to happen to her? What had happened to her? Had she actually turned into a boy? She came to a stop in front of Dr. Stalling. Dr. Stalling shook his forefinger, such a long, knuckly forefinger, at her and said, "Little boy, take off your hat." Valency took off her hat. She had a scrawny little pigtail hanging down her back, but Dr. Stalling was short-sighted and did not perceive it. "Little boy, go back to your seat and always take off your hat in church. Remember." Valency went back to her seat, carrying her hat like an automaton. Presently, her mother came in. "Doss," said Mrs. Stirling, "what do you mean by taking off your hat? Put it on instantly." Valency put it on instantly. She was cold with fear lest Dr. Stalling should immediately summon her up front again. She would have to go, of course. It never occurred to her that one could disobey the rector, and the church was full of people now. But what would she do if that horrible stabbing forefinger were shaken at her again before all those people? Valency sat through the whole service in an agony of dread and was sick for a week afterwards. Nobody knew why. Mrs. Frederick again bemoaned herself of her delicate child. Dr. Stalling found out his mistake and laughed over it to Valency, who did not laugh. She never got over her dread of Dr. Stalling. And now to be caught by him on the street corner, thinking such things. Valency got her John Foster book, Magic of Wings. His latest, all about birds, said Miss Clarkson. She had almost decided that she would go home instead of going to see Dr. Trent. Her courage had failed her. She was afraid of offending Uncle James, afraid of angering her mother, afraid of facing gruff, shaggy-browed old Dr. Trent, who would probably tell her, as he had told Cousin Gladys, that her trouble was entirely imaginary and that she only had it because she liked to have it. No, she would not go. She would get a bottle of Redfern's purple pills instead. Redfern's purple pills were the standard medicine of the Stirling clan. Had they not cured second cousin Geraldine when five doctors had given her up? Valency always felt very skeptical concerning the virtues of the purple pills, but there might be something in them, and it was easier to take them than to face Dr. Trent alone. She would glance over the magazines in the reading room a few times and then go home. Valency tried to read a story, but it made her furious. On every page was a picture of the heroine surrounded by adoring men. And here was she, Valency Stirling, who could not get a solitary beau. Valency slammed the magazine shut. She opened Magic of Wings. Her eyes fell on the paragraph that changed her life. Fear is the original sin, wrote John Foster. Almost all the evil of the world has its origin in the fact that someone is afraid of something. It is a cold, slimy serpent coiling about you. It is horrible to live with fear, and it is, of all things, degrading. Valency shut Magic of Wings and stood up. She would go and see Dr. Trent. Chapter 6. The ordeal was not so dreadful after all. Dr. Trent was as gruff and abrupt as usual, but he did not tell her ailment was imaginary. After he had listened to her symptoms and asked a few questions and made a quick examination, he sat for a moment, looking at her quite intently. Valency thought he looked as if he were sorry for her. She caught her breath for a moment. Was her trouble serious? Oh, it couldn't be, surely. It really hadn't bothered her much. Only lately had it got a little worse. Dr. Trent opened his mouth, but before he could speak, the telephone at his elbow rang sharply. He picked up the receiver. Valency, watching him, saw his face change suddenly as he listened. Yes, yes, what? Yes, yes. A brief interval. My God. Dr. Trent dropped the receiver, dashed out of the room, and upstairs without even a glance at Valency. She heard him rushing madly about overhead, barking out a few remarks to somebody, presumably his housekeeper. Then he came tearing downstairs with a club bag in his hand, snatched his hat and coat from the rack, jerked open the street door, and rushed down the street in the direction of the station. Valency sat alone in the little office, feeling more absolutely foolish than she had ever felt before in her life. Foolish and humiliated. So this was all that had come of her heroic determination to live up to John Foster and cast fair aside. Not only was she a failure as a relative and non-existent as a sweetheart or friend, but she was not even of any importance as a patient. Dr. Trent had forgotten her very presence in his excitement over whatever message had come by the telephone. She had gained nothing by ignoring Uncle James and flying in the face of family tradition. For a moment she was afraid she was going to cry. It was also ridiculous. Then she heard Dr. Trent's housekeeper coming down the stairs. Valency rose and went to the office door. The doctor forgot all about me, she said with a twisted smile. Well, that's too bad, said Mrs. Patterson sympathetically. But it wasn't much wonder, poor man. That was a telegram they phoned over from the port. His son has been terribly injured in an auto accident in Montreal. The doctor had just 10 minutes to catch the train. I don't know what he'll do if anything happens to Ned. He's just bound up in the boy. He'll have to come again, Miss Stirling. I hope it's nothing serious. Oh no, nothing serious, agreed Valency. She felt a little less humiliated. It was no wonder poor Dr. Trent had forgotten her at such a moment. Nevertheless, She felt very flat and discouraged as she went down the street. Valancy went home by the shortcut of Lover's Lane. She did not often go through Lover's Lane, but it was getting near supper time, and it would never do to be late. Lover's Lane wound back of the village, under great elms and maples, and deserved its name. It was hard to go there at any time and not find some canoodling couple, or young girls in pairs, arms intertwined, earnestly talking over their secrets. Valancy didn't know which made her feel more self-conscious and uncomfortable. This evening, she encountered both. She met Connie Hale and Kate Bailey in new pink organdy dresses with flowers stuck coquettishly in their glossy, bare hair. Valancy had never had a pink dress or worn flowers in her hair. Then she passed a young couple she didn't know, dandering along, oblivious to everything but themselves. The young man's arm was around the girl's waist quite shamelessly. Valancy had never walked with a man's arm about her. She felt that she ought to be shocked. They might leave that sort of thing for the screening twilight at least. But she wasn't shocked. In another flash of desperate, stark honesty, she owned to herself that she was merely envious. When she passed them, she felt quite sure they were laughing at her, pitying her. There is that little old maid, Valancy Sterling. They say she never had a beau in her whole life. Valancy fairly ran to get out of Lover's Lane. Never had she felt so utterly colourless and skinny and insignificant. Just where Lover's Lane debouched on the street, an old car was parked. Valancy knew that car well, by sound at least, and everybody in Darewood knew it. This was before the phrase Tin Lizzie had come into circulation, in Darewood at least. But if it had been known, this car was the tinniest of Lizzies, though it was not a Ford but an old grey Slosson. Nothing more battered and disreputable could be imagined. It was Barney Snaith's car, and Barney himself was just scrambling up from under it, in overalls plastered with mud. Valancy gave him a swift, furtive look as she hurried by. This was only the second time she'd ever seen the notorious Barney Snaith, though she had heard enough about him in the 5 years that he had been living up back in Muskoka. The first time had been nearly a year ago, on the Muskoka Road. He had been crawling out from under his car then too, and had given her a cheerful grin as she went by, a little whimsical grin that gave him the look of an amused gnome. He didn't look bad. She didn't believe he was bad, in spite of the wild yarns that were always being told of him. Of course he went tearing in that terrible old grey Slosson through Darewood at hours when all decent people were in bed, often with old roaring Abel, who made the night hideous with his howls. Both of them dead drunk, my dear. And everyone knew that he was an escaped convict and a defaulting bank clerk and a murderer in hiding and an infidel and an illegitimate son of old roaring Abel and the father of roaring Abel's illegitimate grandchild and a counterfeiter and a forger and a few other awful things. But still, Valancy didn't believe he was bad. Nobody with a smile like that could be bad, no matter what he had done. It was that night the Prince of the Blue Castle changed from a being of grim jaw and hair with a dash of premature grey to a rakish individual with overlong tawny hair, dashed with red, dark brown eyes, and ears that stuck out just enough to give him an alert look, but not enough to be called flying jibs. But he still retained something a little grim about the jaw. Barney Snaith looked even more disreputable than usual just now. It was very evident that he hadn't shaved for days, and his hands and arms, bare to the shoulders, were black with grease. But he was whistling gleefully to himself, and he seemed so happy that Valancy envied him. She envied him his light-heartedness and his irresponsibility and his mysterious little cabin up on an island in Lake Mistawis, even his rackety old grey Slosson. Neither he nor his car had to be respectable and live up to traditions. When he rattled past her a few minutes later, bareheaded, leaning back in his Lizzie at a rakish angle, his longish hair blowing in the wind, a villainous-looking old black pipe in his mouth, she envied him again. Men had the best of it, no doubt about that. This outlaw was happy, whatever he was or wasn't. She, Valency Stirling, respectable, well-behaved to the last degree, was unhappy, and had always been unhappy. So there you were. Valency was just in time for supper. The sun had clouded over, and a dismal, drizzling rain was falling again. Cousin Stickles had the neuralgia. Valency had to do the family darning, and there was no time for magic of wings. "Can't the darning wait till tomorrow?" she pleaded. "Tomorrow will bring its own duties," said Mrs. Frederick. Valency darned all the evening and listened to Mrs. Frederick and Cousin Stickles talking the eternal, niggling gossip of the clan as they knitted drearily at interminable black stockings. They discussed second cousin Lillian's approaching wedding in all its bearings. On the whole, they approved. Second cousin Lillian was doing well for herself. "Though she hasn't hurried," said Cousin Stickles. "She must be 25. "There have not, fortunately, been many old maids in our connection," said Mrs. Frederick bitterly. Valency flinched. She'd run the darning needle into her finger. Third cousin Aaron Gray had been scratched by a cat and had blood poisoning in his finger. "Cats are the most dangerous animals," said Mrs. Frederick. "I would never have a cat about the house." She glared significantly at Valency through her terrible glasses. Once, 5 years ago, Valency had asked if she might have a cat. She had never referred to it since, but Mrs. Frederick still suspected her of harboring the unlawful desire in her heart of hearts. Once, Valency sneezed. Now, in the Stirling Code, it was very bad form to sneeze in public. "You can always repress a sneeze by pressing your finger on your upper lip," said Mrs. Frederick rebukingly. 9:30, and so, as Mr. Pepys would say, to bed. But first Cousin Stickles' neuralgic back must be rubbed with Redfern's liniment. Valency did that. Valency always had to do it. She hated the smell of Redfern's liniment. She hated the smug, beaming, portly, bewhiskered, bespeckled picture of Dr. Redfern on the bottle. Her fingers smelled of the horrible stuff after she got into bed, in spite of all the scrubbing she gave them. Valency's day of destiny had come and gone. She ended it as she had begun it, in tears. Chapter 7. There was a rosebush in the little Stirling lawn growing beside the gate. It was called Doss's Rosebush. Cousin Georgiana had given it to Valency 5 years ago, and Valency had planted it joyfully. She loved roses. But, of course, the rosebush never bloomed. That was her luck. Valency did everything she could think of and took the advice of everybody in the clan. But still, the rosebush would not bloom. It throve and grew luxuriantly, with great leafy branches, untouched of rust or spider, but not even a bud had ever appeared on it. Valency, looking at it 2 days after her birthday, was filled with a sudden overwhelming hatred for it. The thing wouldn't bloom. Very well, then, she would cut it down. She marched to the tool room in the barn for her garden knife and went at the rosebush viciously. A few minutes later, horrified Mrs. Frederick came out to the veranda and beheld her daughter slashing insanely among the rosebush boughs. Half of them were already strewn on the walk. The bush looked sadly dismantled. "Doss, what on earth are you doing? Have you gone crazy?" "No," said Valency. She meant to say it defiantly, but habit was too strong for her. She said it deprecatingly. I just made up my mind to cut this bush down. It is no good. It never blooms, never will bloom." "That is no reason for destroying it," said Mrs. Frederick sternly. "It was a beautiful bush and quite ornamental. You have made a sorry-looking thing out of it." "Rose trees should bloom," said Valency, a little obstinately. "Don't argue with me, Doss. Clear up that mess and leave the bush alone. I don't know what Georgiana will say when she sees how you've hacked it to pieces. Really, I'm surprised at you. And to do it without consulting me." "The bush is mine," muttered Valency. "What's that? What did you say, Doss?" "I only said the bush was mine," repeated Valency, humbly. Mrs. Frederick turned without a word and marched back into the house. The mischief was done now. Valency knew she had offended her mother deeply and would not be spoken to or noticed in any way for 2 or 3 days. Cousin Stickles would see to Valency's bringing up, but Mrs. Frederick would preserve the stony silence of outraged majesty. Valency sighed and put away her garden knife, hanging it precisely on its precise nail in the tool shop. She cleared away the several branches and swept up the leaves. Her lips twitched as she looked at the straggling bush. It had an odd resemblance to its shaken, scrawny donor, little Cousin Georgiana herself. "I certainly have made an awful-looking thing of it," thought Valency. But she did not feel repentant, only sorry she had offended her mother. Things would be so uncomfortable until she was forgiven. Mrs. Frederick was one of those women who can make their anger felt all over a house. Walls and doors are no protection from it. "You'd better go downtown and get the mail," said Cousin Stickles when Valency went in. "I can't go. I feel all sort of peaky and piney this spring. I want you to stop at the drugstore and get me a bottle of Redfern's blood bitters. There's nothing like Redfern's bitters for building a body up. Cousin James says the purple pills are the best, but I know better. My poor dear husband took Redfern's bitters right up to the day he died. Don't let them charge you more than 90 cents. I can get it for that at the port. And what have you been saying to your poor mother? Do you ever stop to think, Doss, that you can only have one mother?" "One is enough for me," thought Valency, undutifully, as she went uptown. She got Cousin Stickles' bottle of bitters, and then she went to the post office and asked for her mail at the general delivery. Her mother did not have a box. They got too little mail to bother with it. Valency did not expect any mail except the Christian Times, which was the only paper they took. They hardly got other letters. But Valency rather liked to stand in the office and watch Mr. Carew, the grey-haired, Santa Clausy old clerk, handing out letters to the lucky people who did get them. He did it with such a detached, impersonal, Jove-like air, as if it did not matter in the least to him what supernal joys or shattering horrors might be in those letters for the people to whom they were addressed. Letters had a fascination for Valency, perhaps because she so seldom got any. In her blue castle, exciting epistles, bound with silk and sealed with crimson, were always being brought to her by pages in livery of gold and blue. But in her real life, her only letters were occasional perfunctory notes from relatives or an advertising circular. Consequently, she was immensely surprised when Mr. Carew, looking even more Jovian than usual, poked a letter out to her. Yes, it was addressed to her plainly, in a fierce black hand, "Miss Valency Sterling, Elm Street, Deerwood," and the postmark was Montreal. Valency picked it up with a little quickening of her breath. Montreal. It must be from Dr. Trent. He had remembered her after all. Valency met Uncle Benjamin coming in as she was going out, and was glad the letter was safely in her bag. "What," said Uncle Benjamin, "is the difference between a donkey and a postage stamp?" "I don't know what," answered Valency dutifully. "One you lick with a stick, and the other you stick with a lick. Ha ha." Uncle Benjamin passed in, tremendously pleased with himself. Cousin Stickles pounced on the Times when Valency got home, but it did not occur to her to ask if there were any letters. Mrs. Frederick would have asked it, but Mrs. Frederick's lips were, a present, sealed. Valency was glad of this. If her mother had asked if there were any letters, Valency would have had to admit there was. Then she would have had to let her mother and Cousin Stickles read the letter, and all would be discovered. Her heart acted strangely on the way upstairs, as she sat down by her window for a few minutes before opening the letter. She felt very guilty and deceitful. She had never before kept a letter secret from her mother. Every letter she had ever written or received had been read by Mrs. Frederick. That had never mattered. Valency had never anything to hide. But this did matter. She could not have anyone see this letter. But her fingers trembled with a conscience of wickedness and unfilial conduct as she opened it, trembled a little too, perhaps with apprehension. She felt quite sure there was nothing seriously wrong with her heart, but one never knew. Dr. Trent's letter was like himself, blunt, abrupt, concise, wasting no words. Dr. Trent never beat about the bush. Dear Miss Sterling. And then, a page of black, positive writing. Fancy seemed to read it at a glance. She dropped it on her lap, her face ghost white. Dr. Trent told her that she had a very dangerous and fatal form of a heart disease, angina pectoris, evidently complicated with an aneurysm, whatever that was, and in the last stages. He said, without mincing matters, that nothing could be done for her. If she took great care of herself, she might live a year, but she might also die at any moment. Dr. Trent never troubled himself about euphemisms. She must be careful to avoid all excitement and all severe muscular efforts. She must eat and drink moderately. She must never run. She must go upstairs and uphill with great care. Any sudden jolt or shock might be fatal. She was to get the prescription he enclosed filled and carry it with her always, taking a dose whenever her attacks came on. And he was hers truly, H.B. Trent. Fancy sat for a long while by her window. Outside was a world drowned in the light of a spring afternoon. Skies entrancingly blue. Winds perfumed and free, lovely soft blue hazes at the end of a street. Over at the railway station, a group of young girls was waiting for a train. She could hear their laughter as they chattered and joked. The train roared in and roared out again. But none of these things had any reality. Nothing had any reality except the fact that she only had another year to live. When she was tired of sitting at the window, she went over and lay down on her bed, staring at the cracked, discolored ceiling. The curious numbness that follows on a staggering blow possessed her. She did not feel anything except a boundless surprise and incredulity, behind which was the conviction that Dr. Trent knew his business and that she, Fancy Sterling, who had never lived, was about to die. When the gong rang for supper, Fancy got up and went downstairs mechanically from force of habit. She wondered that she had been let alone so long, but of course, her mother would not pay any attention to her just now. Fancy was thankful for this. She thought the quarrel over the rosebush had been really, as Mrs. Frederick herself might have said, providential. She could not eat anything. But both Mrs. Frederick and Cousin Stickles thought this was because she was deservedly unhappy over her mother's attitude, and her lack of appetite was not commented on. Valency forced herself to swallow a cup of tea, and then sat and watched the others eat, with an odd feeling that years had passed since she had sat with them at the dinner table. She found herself smiling inwardly to think what a commotion she could make if she chose. Let her merely tell them what was in Dr. Trent's letter, and there would be as much fuss made as if, Fancy thought bitterly, they really cared two straws about her. Dr. Trent's housekeeper got word from him today, said Cousin Stickles, so suddenly that Fancy jumped guiltily. Was there anything in thought waves? Mrs. Judd was talking to her uptown. They think his son will recover, but Dr. Trent wrote that if he did, he was going to take him abroad as soon as he was able to travel, and wouldn't be back here for a year at least. That will not matter much to us, said Mrs. Frederick majestically. He's not our doctor. I would not, here she looked or seemed to look accusingly right through Fancy, have him to doctor a sick cat. May I go upstairs and lie down, said Fancy faintly. I have a headache. What has given you a headache? Asked Cousin Stickles, since Mrs. Frederick would not. The question has to be asked. Fancy could not be allowed to have headaches without interference. You ain't in the habit of having headaches. I hope you're not taking the mumps. Here, try a spoonful of vinegar. Piffle, said Fancy rudely, getting up from the table. She did not care just then if she were rude. She had had to be so polite all her life. If it had been possible for Cousin Stickles to turn pale, she would have. As it was not, she turned yellower. Are you sure you ain't feverish, Doss? You sound like it. You go and get right into bed, said Cousin Stickles, thoroughly alarmed. And I'll come up and rub your forehead and the back of your neck with Redford's liniment. Fancy had reached the door, but she turned. I won't be rubbed in Redford's liniment, she said. Cousin Stickles stared and gasped. What do you mean? I said I won't be rubbed with Redford's liniment, repeated Valancy. Horrid, sticky stuff. And it has the vilest smell of any liniment I ever saw. It's no good. And I want to be left alone, that's all. Valancy went out, leaving Cousin Stickles aghast. She's feverish. She must be feverish, ejaculated Cousin Stickles. Mrs. Frederick went on eating her supper. It did not matter whether Valancy was or was not feverish. Valancy had been guilty of impertinence to her. Good night.